Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Welcome to True Crime Cast. This is a bonus episode. John here. Jamie and I had an opportunity to sit down and interview Mickey Stein's attorney, Jeremy Bartley. Now, if you're not familiar with this case, Mickey Stein's was a sheriff in Letcher County, Kentucky, who just a couple of months ago went out to lunch with a local judge, Judge Mullins in Letcher County. They went out to lunch, and then we have video footage of the two of them in the judge's chambers inside the courthouse. We don't have audio, so don't really know what transpired to lead the next thing to happen, but we know that Mickey Stein's shot and killed the judge. What we don't know is why. So today we were able to sit down and speak with Mickey Stein's attorney, again, Jeremy Bartley, and maybe gain a little bit of insight into how he's going to approach the case from a defensive perspective, from the defense's perspective. I think you guys will really enjoy that. Without further ado, please enjoy this bonus episode and this interview with Jeremy Bartley.
We're here with Jeremy Bartley, attorney for Mickey Stein's, who is accused in the shooting of Sheriff Kevin Mullins. Jeremy, thanks for hanging out with us for a few minutes today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I've got two other co-counsel on this case, and I certainly would be remiss not to mention their names as well. First of all, my wife and law partner, Carrie Bartley, and James Cox, Jim Cox. He has his own practice, but both of those are hard at work today, so they sent me to do the heavy lifting with you, Jamie, but thanks for having me on.
Have they chosen you to be the face of this operation? Is that what you're telling us?
No, listen, my wife is certainly the face. I'm not sure what I add. It's not the mind and it's not the face, but maybe the mouth. That's probably what my wife would tell you, Jamie.
My mom always told me I have a face for radio. So yeah. Thanks, Mom, for the encouragement. Working out.
That's rough if Mom tells you that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I was dumb, so I took it as a compliment.
It's tough love. Then, you know? Tough love.
Man, this is a... Go ahead, Jamie.
No, you go ahead.
This is a very difficult case to work. I'm sure you're used to working so many difficult cases. How did you get involved in this particular case?
Yeah, so a little bit of background. I grew up in Eastern Kentucky. My wife and I both are natives of Pike County. And in particular, she went to Belfry. She's from that end of the county. I lived in Virgie, which is a hop, skip, and a jump over to Jenkins and Neon. And we have a lot of mutual friends with the Stein's family. One of the mutual friends made the introduction, and it was a situation. Obviously, we'd seen some coverage of that before we met with the client, but that's sort of how that came to be, to answer your question. And in terms of difficult cases, I served as an assistant Commonwealth attorney for 16 plus years. A portion of that was part-time, as I also had a civil practice. But, I handled, any range of cases, tried quite a few cases, many involving, anything ranging from sexual assault, to child abuse cases, to murder, drug cases, and fishing without a license and everything along the way. So I've seen a lot of cases over the years. It's my 20th year of practice. This is certainly one of the most nuanced and challenging cases that I've taken on.
Sure. And it hit the ground running for sure with all of the rumors swirling around. How do you handle that in the world of social media with speculation and with everybody talking? And I say, how do you handle that? How do you handle that, A, from any statements you do or don't make, but also for the jury pool hearing all this, potential jury pool, I should say.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that's one of the interesting things about this case. There's so many interesting things. And but I think one of the most difficult things that we've encountered is that there's not, lots of times you go into a case and there's, you know, very little. People are talking very little about the background, about what's happening. In this instance, it's just the opposite. And the big challenge is distilling what is A, relevant to our case, and B, separating fact from fiction. And, you know, in this day and age, you're not doing your job if you don't have someone on your staff that's looking at that stuff, right? And you know, we have to be investigative. At the same time, you know, we're doing a parallel investigation while the Commonwealth is. And I think that you certainly have to have someone looking at that stuff and identifying what can be usable in your case, what is not. And I think that it's sifting those things out has been an initial challenge for sure.
With all
in terms of the jury pool, and the second part of your question, Jamie, I didn't address it, but in terms of the jury pool, you know, I was asked, I think it was by the public radio folks recently, and I saw some, took a little bit of criticism when I said that I thought that there's no reason that I see that this case shouldn't stay in Letcher County. And I cited the case of the year before I came to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office here in Somerset. Eddie Montgomery was my boss. He's now a circuit judge, but he was the Commonwealth Attorney, and they tried the case of Ken White, who was convicted of being part of the group that assassinated Sam Catron. Yeah. And, you know, in some ways, you know, social media was more of in its infancy. But in terms of national coverage and widespread news coverage, I mean, at that time, it was one of the biggest cases going. And that case was tried right here. And sort of the thought was, there's no place you can go in Kentucky that hadn't heard of that case. Mm-hmm. Okay. And for me, I see a great similarity to this case. And, you know, the presumption is that you have a trial by your peers. And, you know, I think there's a geographic component to that, being an Eastern Kentuckian. You know, Eastern mm-hmm. Kentucky is a different region than even here in Somerset. And it's different if you go into Western Kentucky or into the metro areas like Louisville or Lexington. You know, so I think for me, you start with the presumption that your peers are where you were. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, everyone wants to ask me, where is this case going to be held and what judge is going to hear it? And I don't know ultimately in terms of judges that, you know, they will do their thing getting a special judge. If they recuse, I would assume the Letcher County judges may, but I can't speak for them. I don't know.
Right.
But ultimately, you know, that's an issue that will be addressed. You know, the Commonwealth can address that as well. Lots of times you're looking at a change of venue motion from a defendant, right? And we recently tried the case out of Laurel County, the Our client was accused of being involved in a DUI death with the London police officer. Mm-hmm. And we tried that actually against Mr. Steele, who's the prosecutor on this case. And we saw it and got a change of venue over to Bowling Green. But in that instance, our client was he was from Tennessee. So there wasn't a great nexus to either place, but certainly the coverage there was very, in that instance, I would say hostile to our client. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly you got to be thinking of that as well. But, you know, as it goes today, as we sit here today, this case happened in Letcher County.
Yeah.
Do you know where this case will be tried if it does go to trial? I've thought I heard this would also be tried in Bowling Green. Is that not accurate?
As far as I'm concerned, we will, we have no interest in having this case moved anywhere.
And it's usually the defense that would make that request, right?
Generally, yeah. It is. I mean, I think that there is an avenue for the Commonwealth to potentially raise that issue, but as far as we're concerned, you know, Letcher County is where it occurred. The citizens of Letcher County have the most at stake in this case, and that would be a jury of his peers. And you know, and I'm sure that if the counter argument was, oh, wow, the concentration of coverage. But again, I just don't think you're going to go anywhere in the state of Kentucky right now. Maybe not in the nation, mm-hmm. where you're not going to have large pockets of people that have, exposure to it. But that's, you know, whether people have seen anything whatsoever, that's not really dispositive, you know. I mean, there's a more detailed analysis, and there are other options of potentially getting folks from adjacent counties to enlarge the jury pool. But to answer your question, you know, as far as where it's going to be held, there is no mechanism for a grand jury that I know of, and never seen it in my practice as a prosecutor or otherwise, that you get a grand jury to hear the case and issue charges anywhere other than the county where the event alleged to have occurred.
So I think I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. So I say going into this case, it's our position that we're in Letcher County.
Okay.
I think that what I was referring to is a product of misinformation. I remember hearing that it was already said to be moved to Bowling Green. So I'm glad that that's not the case.
Are there any specific rumors that have been swirling around? We don't have time to go into all of them because some of them are ridiculous. But any that you want to address that are out there that you say, let's just put that one to bed right now?
You know, I think that the one common refrain or the common question that or rumor that has been out there, it had actually taken root well before we even had the preliminary hearing. And so just so you know, in terms of evidence that we have from the Commonwealth, everything that we know about their case was contained in that hearing. I don't know mm-hmm. if you guys had the opportunity to watch the hearing, but mm-hmm. everything we know that they are alleging at this point, we know from there. I mean, there's no mechanism in district court for us to get the discovery and privy to the investigation at this point until an indictment is rendered and then we seek discovery through the rules of criminal procedure. But, you know, one of the things that was out there and has been out there was about, you know, whether there was some nexus between the judge and the and our client's daughter. Right.
Right.
And the question that I ask, the series of questions I ask relative to that issue to the officer that testified was, he testified that there was a call made from, you know, from the judge's phone to the daughter, of our client. And I asked him the question concerning whether he confirmed, my intention in asking the question was whether he confirmed that that was the daughter's number that was on the phone. Now, the way the question was framed may have been ambiguous. Some people took that to be that it was a contact that was previously saved in the phone. I didn't take his response to be that, and I believe the KSP has made some public statements that that was, you know, that that's not true. At this point, I have said we're not aware that that is going to be true in terms of any relationship of that nature, with the caveat that, you know, until we get the reports of the phones and can verify that ourselves, then, I mean, it's obviously because of the fact that that is out there, we have to explore that and see if that, you know, it is potentially an issue, but there's nothing that I know of right now that would lead me to believe that that is true. Of course, we're going to continue to examine it. We'll get the phones and look at it, and I want to see the reports myself and confirm. You know, you can mark that off and understand it. But I think, you know, the focus that we have cited is the statement that was allegedly made by our client that he expressed concern for the welfare of his wife and his daughter, which, you know, seems to indicate a threat to them. You know, and that at the time that he was acting, did, you know, that he perceived a threat. I think that that is a more appropriate examination of this case than potentially the other things. But again, we're very early on in what we know still. You know, I mean, this is not a whodunit, okay? Let's be very blunt about it. I mean, you know, this is not an issue whodunit. It's why was it done? And, you know, I've stated in, before that I think, you know, my position was at the preliminary hearing at its, at the Commonwealth's, on the Commonwealth's ceiling, this should be manslaughter one. But that doesn't mean that I concede this is a manslaughter case and he should be convicted of that. That's a partial defense. And I believe it should be there's no evidence that they could even begin to describe that this was a pre-planned event or in some way there was a plot. No, it appeared to me that from what they at the point of the testimony we had, which is hearsay comes in, it's a very low standard, it's probable cause, and the detective that testified at the time had very little to say that was really useful. But you know, my position at that time was that I've heard nothing that supports murder. The murder statute itself requires that you have to exclude extreme emotional disturbance, and everything that they testified to was that something occurred in the chambers prior to the footage they showed, conveniently, potentially, that, you know, that there was something in the moment that caused this reaction, right? And to me, that's textbook extreme emotional disturbance, but that does not mean that we can see that as the only defense. You know, there are a plethora of other defenses that could come into play. And at this point, we've not announced publicly or stated publicly what we think that'll be, but we do believe there will be a defense, an absolute defense as well, meaning that we would urge acquittal, and not, you know, we're not conceding manslaughter first. And that, you know, basically what that would look like from a from a generic top-down view would be, you know, we don't think that you should find him guilty at all based upon X. Mm-hmm. But at the most, if you do find him guilty at the highest level, we believe that, you know, that the most you should be able to find would be extreme emotional disturbance issue out there would be man one. And so I think there was some confusion about our position that, oh, it's extreme emotional disturbance, so they're only urging they're only going to put forth a partial defense. That's not accurate.
Okay.
There will be an absolute defense as well.
Can you elaborate on the process of how those charges will go moving forward? Will the grand jury decide on the bill for murder and manslaughter? Who will make that determination and when about what the actual charges will be if this goes to trial?
Yeah. So there is the, the way this goes is basically the grand jury process is not to get too basic, but just for any listeners, this is not something that most folks deal with on a daily basis. And,
thankfully,
with the efforts of folks like yourself, they're doing a great job. I think it's a great thing that, you know, that true crime and a lot of these legal shows that are out there are there. If not, first of all, they're entertaining, right? Mm-hmm. But second of all, I think that, you know, once upon a time they taught civics in school, but today they don't seem to go there a whole lot. And there's so many misunderstandings about the way the legal system works. So at a base level, I think that that these things at least expose us to what that looks like. Right. So a grand jury is a secret body that they're an investigative body that meet secretly. Right. And there's many reasons why you meet secretly to, if 12 people from a small community are going to get together and decide to initiate charges, you don't necessarily want everyone knowing where they're going to be and who they are. And, every jurisdiction may have different ways that they, you know, how long the grand jury serves. That's not set in stone. I know that here in Pulaski and Lincoln Rock Castle and Lincoln Rock Castle and Pulaski, the 28th Circuit, they're impaneled for a year generally, and they meet at a prescribed time monthly in each county. And the prosecutor, in general, most cases you see, you know, there'll be one witness. It'll be the lead investigator on the case and the prosecutor. There, you know, I'm not allowed to be there. I can't argue the case.
Right.
On behalf of the defense, there are mechanisms during which you can request to put on certain evidence. You can ask that it be presented, I've done it before. It happens. It in the right cases, it can be effective and appropriate, but at any rate, the grand jury, the 12 folks hear one side of this case, and the Commonwealth Attorney's role in that is legal, to be a legal advisor. And when done appropriately, you would advise the grand jury of the potential charges, and they make the decision what charges are appropriate, if any. Mm-hmm. It requires generally 9 of the 12 to vote based upon a probable cause standard. Okay. Now, in terms of in Kentucky, there are some jurisdictions, and if you watch you see, and I think probably the most recent example I could maybe give is the Murdoch case in South Carolina. I think that if I recall correctly, they basically charge the lesser included crimes along with the highest level crime. But the way that generally indictments work in Kentucky is that the grand jury would return an indictment on the highest level of culpability that they believe is appropriate, right? And then if and when the case goes to trial, then at that point, the parties ask for jury instructions on lesser included. So if a case is indicted as a murder, then you ask for the lesser included of, you know, of we don't have different degrees of murder. It's only murder in Kentucky. Okay. It can either be wanton or intentional, but it's both murder. And then below that would be manslaughter first. You know, in the right scenario, I don't know that it is applicable here, but you could get a manslaughter second instruction and a reckless homicide instruction, right? Of course, with the instruction of, you know, guilty or not guilty on each of those. Okay. So to answer your question, the grand jury itself, they make the decision as to what ultimately by vote, what level of charges should be returned. But generally, in practice, the grand jury leans very heavily, shall we say, on what the prosecutor advises.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it is.
You can indict a ham sandwich, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I see that's the old adage, and 99% of the time that's true. I will tell you that I've had, you know, I've presented cases as a prosecutor that I didn't want to see indicted, and they indicted it. And I've seen others that I thought they should indict, they didn't. I mean, they, you know, and in reality, sometimes if you got a really tough case as a prosecutor, you want to present, sometimes you won't call it in January. You got a fresh grand jury that hasn't developed that rapport with the prosecutor, then you may not feel as confident as you would be in November.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there are factors at play, but in general, you know, as a practical matter, what the prosecutor wants indicted, the prosecutor can most of the time get it indicted.
Sure. I don't that's have the, I'm sorry.
No,
I don't have the numbers in front of me. I think you can, please correct me if I'm wrong. I think out of 100 cases that would come up through a grand jury, I think most of those don't end up going to trial. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but the next question is, do you see this case going to trial? Do you feel like this will end up before a jury at some point?
Well, I mean, I think that we're just so early, that's difficult to know. I mean, at this point, you know, I think the question is, will it get indicted? Mm-hmm. And if so, on what charges? Okay. And so, but then from there are so many factors, you know, and once the criminal litigation begins, there are so many different factors that go into it. You learn a lot more about the case. The Commonwealth starts to learn more about your case. And I think you're right. I mean, goodness, it may be below 2% of cases that are tried anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's both civil side and the criminal side. I mean, trials are in lots of ways, I think, unfortunately, they're a dying breed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, folks are, there's such uncertainty with any jury, and we live in such a divided society in many ways that, you know, I've seen good cases on whatever side I'm on that became losers. And I've seen bad cases that you scratch your head and you're like, I can't believe I won that. You know, the uncertainty really has to be a factor when you're going through the litigation process. And certainly, no matter what case it is, this case or any other case, you have to consider the offer of settlement that's made, if there is one. And those are things Like I tell every client that comes from our door, there are no guarantees. Cases only end one of two ways. You end it in a plea or you end it with a verdict. And I cannot predict at this point what the Commonwealth, you know, would ever offer, if anything, short of a trial. And I don't know for sure, can never tell you with any level of certainty what 12 people who unfortunately got stuck with $13 a day for sitting on a couple of weeks of trial will do. But we'll certainly evaluate that and as it comes along. But at this point, it's so early. I mean, it's so early. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I think it's just so early. It's difficult for me to tell you. But you have to prepare every case as if you're going to try it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. As soon as it comes to the door, you just, I mean, we have to practice this case just like every other case. And I don't care if it's a DUI or if it's a drug case, whatever it may be, you have to examine all of it, make sure that the constitutional rights are protected, make sure that the evidence supports what they're saying or it doesn't, examine your defenses and then on the other side, look at that offer if there is one and then make a decision, which is ultimately the client's alone. We can advise them, advise of risk and potential outcomes, but ultimately the decision on either, you know, car wreck case, what amount of money you're willing to settle for, or what, you know, what plea you're willing to accept is the client's decision alone. But in terms of this case specifically, we're so early. I could, you know, I would never say never. I mean, there any case could potentially be resolved short of trial. And statistically, that's what happens. You know, this is one that you know, I'm preparing it for trial.
Yeah.
Like I do all of them. And this probably stands a greater chance of having a jury trial than most.
This is a potentially odd question, and I hope it's okay to ask. And if not, you can tell me. You're investigating this, you know, I would assume from all aspects of the case. So, you know, throughout our podcast career for almost 8 years, we want victims' rights and we want victims' family to be heard. There are some cases where perhaps the victims' families would not want everything to be revealed because it may put their loved ones in a negative light. If that's the case, does the victim's family have any say in what kind of offer could be offered to avoid going to trial?
100%. And so, this was always the case. You know, a few years back, we instituted Marcy's Law, which gave heightened requirements on the prosecutor and how they consult with the alleged victim's family and, you know, or the victim itself, him or herself, if they're still living in a case of assault or theft or whatever. But that was always, you know, that was always a consideration that you had to make. But now they even have their a mechanism for having their own representation in court and to have their own attorney present. And I've done that. But you better believe that in any case, the victim is going to have a heavy hand in determining the outcome of the case, or at least having a loud voice in an outcome of a case.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, that I think that as a prosecutor, I know that was sometimes a consideration. You know, trials are, they're hard on everybody, you know, and they're hard on the accused for sure. They're hard on the litigators in the case. They're hard on the family of the accused. They're hard, and they're most certainly very difficult for the families of victims, you know, the victims' family. So, yeah, I think that, you know, I can just say generically that I do believe that in every case, the victim has a very loud voice in the outcome of the case. And rightfully so.
I'm really thankful that we live in a country with the kind of legal system we have, because justice incorporates both the perpetrator and the victims, in my mind. Because I don't think it's justice if your defendant, in this case or any other case, is acquitted on a charge that doesn't match the potential crime. So I don't know. I'm just thankful we live in a country where we have folks like you who do what you do. I'm sure you don't always get the best, you know. I'm sure that some members of the public are like, oh, you're defending, and, you know, this back. Well, you need to make sure that your client gets what's right and what's just as well as any other, you know. So all that rambling to say, I appreciate it.
I will tell you that it doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on. I mean, you know, when I was a prosecutor, you found that no matter what you did, oftentimes, you know, either the law enforcement guys that work the case, they may not agree with the way you handle a plea in that case, you know, you know, I always kind of thought of it as the Goldilocks. You know, in some cases, folks thought that the porridge was too hot. You know, you've gone too hard on Johnny, and then another case, the same case, the people on the other side was like, I can't believe you slapped him on the wrist. And the one thing I have found is that justice is also very relative. Depending upon which side of the fence you're on. And I do believe that the system does not work, you know, and when people ask that question, you know, how do you defend, you know, the thing about it is that you're not only, I have one goal as a defense attorney, and that's to defend my client to the best of his ability. That can look differently in each case. But the one thing that no one should ever waver on is that we should make sure that the government is able to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. We should make sure that law enforcement, when they work their case, that it passes certain constitutional guidelines, because we have to make sure that the system we've set up is protected, right? We have to make sure that, you know, as I defend whatever client I have, that I'm also defending in many ways the Constitution, right? I mean, because if you search my client illegally, and we allow the government to get by with that, it's a very, very slippery slope. Mm-hmm. And so it's not only seeking in every case, what I refer to as mortal combat victory. There are some cases that you test the evidence and you test the means that they obtain the evidence. And after consultation with your client, you determine that, hey, look, you know, the facts fit, the process was correct. And we talk about what is our best outcome? And then you settle the case, right? And then there's other cases where you don't think that they can meet that burden, or you think that something was done incorrectly. And at that point, you have to, you're defending your client, but you're also defending the Constitution. And so, yeah, I think it's important. Yeah, I think it's important that prosecutors take their wide discretionary judgment and use it wisely. I think if everyone does their job to the ultimate level, then you hope that the system's set up for the right outcome to happen. But if everybody doesn't perform at that level, then sometimes you see bad data in equals bad data out. Yep. But if everyone's performing optimally, that's what our system was meant to do. And that's how it is meant to come up with what we determine as justice.
One more question. We really appreciate your time trying to be cognizant of that. You alluded to it earlier, the CCTV footage that was showed in the preliminary hearing, I think was a big shock to the public. Was there shock in the courtroom? Did you know that was coming? Was there any type of conversation?
I suspected. I'll just say I suspected that we could see some footage. I thought that we could. You know, as a prosecutor, when you're in a preliminary hearing, you've got a very, very low burden. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, the officer could have very well gotten up and described what was on the footage. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. And the footage is out there. And the interesting thing for me will be examining the full video, mm-hmm. which we've not seen.
Right.
We have not seen anything other than the, I think it was 17 seconds mm-hmm. Of video. Look, it's disturbing, right? The video is disturbing. Anytime there's a loss of life, it's a terrible outcome, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a terrible situation. And, to see it recorded, and see it displayed in the courtroom where both families were was certainly disturbing for everyone, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I don't think that anyone would say it wasn't uncomfortable. It's disturbing. But I think that what is important for us is to understand how these 17 seconds came to be.
Right.
And I think that you have to contextualize that. It does not mean that it's not, that it is not still disturbing, upsetting. But I think that you have to contextualize it to understand it. Mm-hmm. And that's what we will try to do in our defense.
And if your client did not walk into that room with the mindset of I'm going to shoot this person, and something before that 17 seconds ultimately led to that decision, one of those matches the definition of murder and one doesn't. Is that correct?
Well, it could. I mean, there are a lot of different, depending on what, there are so many different factors, but just to, again, let me back out and say just generically, extreme emotional disturbance is now codified. But if you think about historically how that arose by case law, the term used to always be heat of passion, mm-hmm. right? And it's a crime of passion, a heat of passion. And basically, to paraphrase, it's an event that causes a person to, the situation is such a nature that it causes someone to act with such emotion that at that point, you are acting outside of all consistency with what you normally would act. And so, there are thousands of cases that have been tried and been in front of the Kentucky Supreme Court where you can extrapolate on one end. There are cases where you know, they talk about a cooling off period, and here you got such a finite period of time. I think it would be difficult for anyone to say that there was a cooling off period, depending on what was in the moments prior. But yeah, I mean, I do believe that one of the issues, not the only issue, but one of the issues is, was there any intent to do this? You know, people talk about premeditation. Was, you know, and that's sort of the mindset. Was it, what did he go in there with that intention? And I don't think there's going to be any evidence that they ever put forth that'll show that. I think that there were circumstances that, that will be conceptualized and contextualized. I mean, that will explain better, but I do not see, I just don't see that they can come up with proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this was at most anything other than an EED situation. And again, we think we'll have a, you know, our defense will be, will go farther than that. I'm just saying from a, in the light most favorable to them, what I think that it could end up.
I just want to say thank you again for your time. You did not have to do this, and I really appreciate it.
Yep.
And, yeah.
Wish you good luck moving forward with this and all your other cases, and thanks for defending those that need it. We appreciate you, Mr. Bartley.
Absolutely. As the case goes along, we'll certainly be more specific about the nature of our defense in this case. But certainly we're very early on, and we'll see if there is an indictment, and we'll – put forth a full defense for Mr. Stines. But thank you, gentlemen, for what you do. And thank you for your efforts. And thanks for having us on.
Appreciate it.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.